From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
What do Satchel Paige, Robert Kennedy, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Joseph McCarthy, and Superman have in common? Well, they have all been subjects of books by my guest, Larry Tye. And almost all of them appear in Larry Tye's latest book, The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Larry Tye, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Very great to be back with you again.
So, Larry Tye, when you write a book, the first part of the process, I imagine, would be, what would Gary Shapiro like to read next?
Absolutely. That's the only criteria that matters.
Because you always write about stuff that I'm interested in. Before we get to the Jazzmen, let me ask you, you know, having written so passionately about Senator Robert F. Kennedy, I love that book so much. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about RFK Jr.'s presidential campaign.
So the campaign makes me sad on two levels. One is that it's just a distraction from the real choice I think that we have today in our choice of presidents. And I think that it is sad that if his name was not RFK Jr., if he were any of the 10 other kids that Bobby had or had any other name, we wouldn't be paying attention. I think there's something especially intriguing to headline writers about being able to perpetually say he's RFK Jr. And I think it would. So Bobby loved all of his 11 kids. He had a special bond with RFK Jr. because of his love of environmental issues. And yet this campaign would, I think, break his heart and is doing that to a number of his siblings and to his mother.
Well, do you have any idea why he's doing it?
I think he's doing it because he can, because he's got a chance that people will listen to him in a way that he never dreamed would happen. And I want to give him credit and think that he thinks that the issues he's raising really matter and aren't being raised elsewhere. And as I say, I think it's a distraction.
Well, thank you for that. Now, your new book is called The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. And I know you've just written, 400 pages about it, but the subtitle says that these men transformed America. And I was asking, what was America before them and what was America after them?
So transformed is a big word, and it's a big claim to make that they really changed the country. I think that your listeners know that they changed the country in terms of the music they came up with, and nobody needs me to write the 101st or 1001st book on these guys' impact on jazz and on the music scene generally. What I think they also did, the other half of their legacy, was that they pushed back against the Jim Crow racist segregation laws and practices in America that they grew up with, that they had to tolerate throughout their 50-year careers, and they made it different. But I also think you shouldn't trust me when I say that. You should look at what Martin Luther King said in two little notice speeches in the 1960s, where he was essentially saying, if these guys hadn't set the table, that the civil rights movement couldn't have made the gains they did as quickly as they did on issues like integrating our schools. That these men, what I think they did in a really interesting and easy to miss way, is that they opened America's ears and souls, not just to the magnificence of their music, but to the potential for Black genius. White men who would never have let a Black cross their threshold wooed their sweethearts with the music of the gravel-throated Louis Armstrong and the Duke Ellington Orchestra. That white women, who if a Black man were approaching them on the sidewalk, would walk to the other side of the street when they were in the privacy of their own living room, they kicked off their heels and they tapped their toes to the music of the swinging Count Basie band. And I think for once, race fell away as America just listened.
Well, do you think that either of the three of them, any of the three of them, I should say, had the intent of transforming America in this way?
Good question. And the answer is absolutely not. That they said and they meant when they said repeatedly that they wanted their music to speak for itself, that they felt that their music was good and would sell records and would have people interested in listening to their bands. And they said that's all they had in mind. And that may have been all they had in mind at the beginning. But I'd love to, if I could have a minute to give brief anecdotes about each of them in terms of the kinds of things that pushed them to do more than have us just pay attention to their music. With Louis Armstrong, it was the fact that even when he was the headliner at a Las Vegas casino, he had to enter through the kitchen because that was the only way blacks were allowed into those casinos. With Duke Ellington, it was the idea that when he played at a place like Lynchburg, Virginia, his manager went out looking for a hotel that would accept him as a black man to stay there the night. And when he finally found a hotel owner who was willing to let Ellington stay there, this guy explained to Duke's manager that, of course, there would be an extra charge for pillowcases and sheets because they would have to burn them after a black man had stayed there. And with Count Basie, it was when he went to a theater in Philadelphia and played, getting 10 standing ovations. After he got done with his performance and when he went out in front of the theater, a white guy tossed him his car keys and said, "Valet, get me my car." And there was an assumption, not just in the 30s and 40s, but into the 50s and 60s, that these artistic geniuses were still second-class citizens. And in each case, and we can go through what they did specifically, but in each case, they realized at some point that they had to use this megaphone they had to say something about race as well as about jazz.
Well, famously, Louis Armstrong was always accused of being an Uncle Tom. You want to address that?
So he was accused of being an Uncle Tom, if not an Aunt Jemima. And young white and black militants, young people growing up in that era like me, who saw him on television using several handkerchiefs in his act and hemming it up on stage, we assumed that, yes, he was a great trumpet player, but he was not a very serious guy. And my book is partly my own mea culpa, saying I got him totally wrong. I didn't understand that the stress that he was under was extraordinary. It wasn't just that he was on the road 365 days a year. It was that the kinds of incidents that I talked about with him in Las Vegas happened everywhere he went. And he would begin every morning spending 30 minutes in the bathroom rolling a big fat joint. He would end every evening in his dressing room, rolling another joint. And that wasn't just because he was tired or because he liked getting high. He was tired. He did like getting high, but it was the only way he had to lower this racial stress that was a big part of his life. And he told us, I think, what he was really like. One day in 1957, when he was in a hotel room and a young reporter came in to interview him, and the reporter said, "What do you think about what's going on now in Little Rock, Arkansas?" And to remind your listeners who don't remember what happened in 57 in Little Rock, a federal judge ordered that the all-white Central High School had to be integrated, and 9 black kids were the guinea pigs for this integration effort. The governor of Arkansas, a racist governor named Orville Faubus, said essentially, "They will come into this school over my dead body." Dwight Eisenhower, our war hero president, said, "I'm not going to send in federal troops. This is a state and a local matter." Louis Armstrong blew up. When this reporter asked him, "What do you think of the governor?" he used a word that begins with M and that ends with R, and that I won't say on a family-oriented podcast like this, but it ended up being translated in the family newspaper to an uneducated plowboy. What he called Dwight Eisenhower ended up making it into the newspaper, which was a gutless so-and-so. And he just lost it. He said, what is going on in America that these black kids have no support and protection from our leading public officials. Now, I can't prove a cause and effect, but I'm convinced that Dwight Eisenhower sent in the federal troops that he did because his buddy Louis Armstrong had called him out. And Armstrong was about the only prominent leader to be as forceful as he was. And yet, having been called an Uncle Tom when he did nothing, when he used strong language in a situation like this, he was called an unpatriotic American. He couldn't get it right on either side. He did too little, he did too much, but I think he got it just right.
One of my favorite Louis Armstrong moments on film is the scene in the movie High Society where he and Bing Crosby sing Now You Has Jazz. And Bing puts his arm around Louis, and that was like, what, 1956? That must have been a controversial moment in movies.
So everything Louis did ended up being controversial. He was a pioneer in movies. He was out there not just as a band leader, but as a star in movies earlier than just about anybody in Black America. And his pals, like Bing Crosby, like Frank Sinatra, loved being on stage with him. The only issue they had with being on stage with him is that the cameras almost gravitated to Armstrong rather than them because he was such a charismatic figure. He could, with his trumpet, he could make you want to spend an hour with him. With his voice, he could make you want to spend hours with him. And he had this magnetic presence that was really interesting because a guy who's a reporter in New Orleans dug up somewhere this old movie camera projection of this newsstand boy who looked like he was about 11 or 12 years old in New Orleans, on the streets of New Orleans, back in the early 1900s. And he did scientific analysis of it and showed that that was Louis Armstrong. And even at age 10 or 11, he was magnetic. All he was doing was hawking newspapers, but you wanted to be with that kid and you wanted to buy his newspaper.
Well, what, can you reflect a little bit on that? Because this book is equally about Armstrong, Ellington, and Count Basie. A little bit of the differences musically between them.
Sure.
Yeah.
If I could start out actually with the difference in terms of where they came from, which said a lot about the differences that they showed later musically and personality-wise. They came from three very different parts of America, even though they were born within 5 years of one another, and they had in common the idea that all of them lasted at the height of their careers for a full 50 years. They came from different surroundings that determined who they were. Louis Armstrong grew up in a neighborhood of segregated New Orleans that was so tough that it was called the battlefield. And at age 13, his life, I think, was saved when he was tossed into a reform school for 18 months. A lot of the kids he hung with on the street didn't make it into their teenage years. And Louis Armstrong learned in that reform school in the model of Booker T. Washington, one of the famous black philosophers of the era. He learned to do something better than anybody else could do and that nobody could take away from him. And that was to play initially the bugle, then the cornet, then the trumpet. Hundreds of miles away in Washington, D.C., in the same era, Duke Ellington was growing up in a middle-class household that was a whole lot more comfortable than what Armstrong had dealt with. And at a very young age, when Duke would walk down the steep stairs in his home every morning, he would tell his young nephews who were at the bottom of the steps, "Bow to me." He would tell his young nieces, "It's time to curtsy." And he would tell everybody, adults and children, "Applaud, applaud, because someday the world is going to know me as the great and the grand Duke Ellington." And he had a sense of royalty to come at a very young age, and he lived up to that sense, that high-minded sense of himself. Again, hundreds of miles away in a community called Red Bank, New Jersey, that if any listeners haven't been to, they shouldn't bother going to because there's nothing there. In Red Bank, New Jersey, a young Count Basie was growing up and telling everybody who would listen that he couldn't wait to get the heck out of Red Bank. He initially thought the way out of town was joining the circus. It ended up that he could play the piano well enough that he became a protege of the great Fats Waller in New York, and he left town. And they all left with a different sense of who they were, of what America was like, because they had seen it through a different lens. And to get to your question of what they were going to try to do musically. And Lewis was very much a solo actor. Even though he played with different ensembles over the years, it was really all about him and his trumpet and his voice. Duke was able to do things, combine things that almost no musicians in American history had done. He composed 6,000 songs. He could arrange. He could play a terrific piano, and he assembled one of the great orchestras of all times. The one who had the least ego was Count Basie, and he was all about being a band leader. And that was great for his side men and side women because they got to take center stage because he didn't need to be there.
Well, could they all read music?
That's a great question, and that was never determined to anybody's satisfaction with Louis Armstrong. It was initially, he sort of played along with all the stories that he didn't know, that he was sort of a savant and he didn't need to read music and he could just sit down and play it. But I think he could read music, if not at the very beginning, then he learned it on the riverboats that took him musically and physically from New Orleans to the next stage of his career in Chicago. Duke clearly could read music, and Count Basie, I never saw anybody question that, and I don't question it.
And what about other instruments? I mean, they're all known primarily for one instrument, but could they play other instruments as well?
So not really. They, I'm sure, could have if they had tried, but with Duke and the Count, they were so good on the piano that there was never really any need to experiment with anything else. And with Lewis, he could clearly play other horn instruments. He had started out a lot on the cornet before he switched to the trumpet, but his other instrument was his voice. And in Chicago, which is where his career really took off, young kids were so dazzled by his raspy voice that during the middle of winter, they would drive around in their cars with their head out the window, hoping to catch cold, so they could sound like the amazing Louis Armstrong. And if there was anybody's voice that I can think of that was unlikely to be as famous and as celebrated, it was Louis Armstrong.
Well, you mentioned in your book that you think Armstrong's voice led to, you know, Bob Dylan and James Brown or Mick Jagger or less, or, you know, trained voices taking up the stage. What about other people like Jimmy Durante made some records? He probably wouldn't have ever thought about doing that if not for Armstrong.
So I think he gave hope to everybody with a so-so voice that if they put enough heart into their voice, they could make it. But it's also interesting, one of the many people, as you mentioned, there were people in the folk world like Dylan, there were people in the jazz world, but among the many rock people who took inspiration from Louis Armstrong was a guy named Paul McCartney. And McCartney recently worked an interesting deal with the people who run the Louis Armstrong House and Museum in Queens. And the deal was the museum people asked Paul McCartney to join them in raising money for their museum. And McCartney said, I'll do it on one condition. The condition is that I get to have for a whole weekend one of Louis Armstrong's trumpets, because he so adored him that the idea of just tooting on the trumpet, I don't know how well he can play the trumpet, but it worked. He got a trumpet for a weekend, and the Armstrong House got a lot of money thanks to his fundraising. And that is the kind of adoration that the greatest musicians on the planet had for these three.
Well, I think you would agree that Bing Crosby is probably one of the most influential of all vocalists in popular music, and he took a lot from Armstrong and gave a lot back, but he really admired Louis Armstrong's vocal stylings.
He did, and I love hearing the duets that they did together, but I love hearing Armstrong with anybody. When I'm bored and sitting around the house, I will ask my smart device to play Louis Armstrong in Ella Fitzgerald, or Louis in Bing, or Louis in his buddy, and why am I blanking on who just died and had like a 70-year career? Oh, Tony Bennett.
Tony Bennett
also, he loved playing with the Basie band and all of these guys. The idea of getting to sit and do a duet with Louis Armstrong or play with the Basie band backing you up, it was just irresistible. And it didn't matter if they were jazz or any other form.
Of course, both Ellington and Basie cut great sides with Frank Sinatra and appeared on television with him.
They did. And the when Basie was going to Las Vegas, so Sinatra, as anybody who lived through that era knows, owned Las Vegas. Whether he was mobbed up or not, he was clearly a celebrity in Las Vegas. And he would tell people his bodyguards would be assigned to take care of Basie during the time Basie was in Vegas with Sinatra. And he would say, break a leg if anybody does anything to interfere with what Count Basie does. And nobody would think of Frank Sinatra as having been a racial pioneer, but he was, and he showed it with these three musicians.
Well, there's a great television special of Frank's in which he's singing with Count Basie, and he says, "Now, Bill," and he calls him Bill. That must have been a special privilege to be able to call him Bill.
He did, and the people who really know, all of these guys had a bunch of nicknames, and Count Basie gave himself the nickname Count, much like Duke Ellington had dubbed himself Duke. But Basie's real friends would call him Bill, and some of them Willie, which was one of his first nicknames way back.
How do you conduct an orchestra from the piano?
Not easy to do it. You do it with your eyebrows giving a certain kind of twitch. You do it with your fingers sticking up occasionally when they weren't on the piano keys. You do it with a band that is so attuned to your music and understands that you're understated and you don't want to be up there waving a baton. And it would be kind of difficult to be up there with a baton if you're playing the piano, that you do it by just being somebody whose even toes send a signal to the rest of the orchestra. And Basie was that good, and his bandmates had been with him long enough that they knew just how to read his moves, moods, and read his intonations as they were playing a song.
Also, I want to ask you about that yachting cap that Basie wore. What's the origin of that?
Nobody is quite sure where the yachting cap came from. And I think what happened with the yachting cap is that as he balded, he wanted some cap on his head. And he looked for the ultimate democratic hat that sent a signal. It wasn't a fancy captain's hat. It was just sort of, it was what looked like a ragged yachting cap. And it was just Count Basie being Bill Basie, being a down-to-earth guy, which is what he really was.
Well, Larry Tye, in your new book, The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America, and earlier in this conversation, you made a reference to side women. And I was interested in that. I mean, I know there are, of course, female vocalists with these bands, but you're saying there were women playing in the band.
So I'm saying that everybody knows that when you type on a computer and you make a mistake about a word spelling or whether a word is contracted or not, that the computer will autocorrect. If you type in the word side man, it will not autocorrect because side man is a word in Webster's dictionary and everywhere else. If you type in the word side women, your computer will tell you you made a mistake because our vocabulary doesn't have that word as an officially recognized word. And the music world back in the time that Basie, Ellington, and Armstrong were playing didn't recognize anything other than vocalists. And even vocalists had slurs sort of thrown at them. They were thrushes. They were canaries. It was really sad that talented instrumentalists, if they happened to be women, couldn't find jobs, and band leaders were even rarer, finding them of the female gender. And one of the few exceptions was a woman who most people wouldn't recognize if I only told you her first two names, which were Lillian Hardin. But if I added her last name, which was Armstrong, she was Lewis's second wife, people might remember that she was Hot Lil, who played on the piano in what may have been the greatest jazz recordings ever made almost exactly 100 years ago, sessions called the Hot Fives and then the Hot Sevens. And in the Hot Fives, Lil was the hot piano player. She was an instrumentalist. She could arrange. She was the one who launched Lewis's career by recognizing that he shouldn't just be King Oliver's trumpet player. He should be out there as the headliner. And she was even a band leader. And it was really rare, and it was sad. And if you were a Black woman, you had that double stigma.
I'm also interested in the labels. Like Jolson recorded for Brunswick, and Crosby recorded for Decca, and Sinatra for Columbia, then Capitol, then Reprise. But these guys, they all recorded for every label. Did they never have a home in terms of their recordings?
So they had managers who kept looking for better deals with them, and they could have had a home any place they wanted. But it was so unusual that somebody would last a half century at the top of their world that the temptation, it would be like a baseball player today lasting with one team for half a century. And you look at all the great ones, and it's not a sign that they're not wanted by teams. The idea that they jump, that Ohtani has, you know, left his one team and joined another one this season, it's a sign that everybody wants them. And that's exactly what happened after their early days with all three of these people. They had labels that wanted them, and they had managers who had no loyalty other than to getting the biggest buck that they could for their guys.
One of Armstrong's biggest hits, Hello Dolly, I think it's recorded for Cap or Dot or one of those really small labels. It was a gigantic hit, right?
It was not just a gigantic hit. It sold 3 million records. And at age 63, and imagine that, at 63, Louis Armstrong's version of Hello Dolly knocked the Beatles off number one in the Billboard charts. He was amazing. And if you look at the song, that is an incredibly mediocre pop tune, but in Louis Armstrong's hands, it became popular enough that it made the Broadway version of Hello Dolly with Carol Channing a hit. It's normally a play that makes a song a hit, and Louis made her play popular.
And Barbara Streisand made sure that he was singing it in her movie.
Exactly. Hey, how could you have Hello Dolly and not have Louis Armstrong singing it?
How did that come about, his appearance in that film?
So I think that she asked, and she knew it was so popular, his singing of it, that it became, in Frank Sinatra's hands, Hello Louie, and instead of Dolly. And it was just the, if you had the guy there and he was alive and well and Barbara Streisand could entice him to do it, it was too tempting, and he would do anything that brought him before big audiences. And it wasn't just about the paychecks, because clearly later in life, when he was doing things like that, he didn't need the paychecks.
You mentioned in your book, The Jazz Men, Larry Tye, that the three main characters in your story never took the stage together, although there are pairings of almost every other combination.
Take the stage together, and they paired only rarely because I think they were all stars. And who was going to be top billing if you had Duke Ellington with Louis Armstrong? Why should either of them share the stage? Anybody else they shared the stage with, they knew they were the headliner. It would have been up to the venue organizer, the host, to decide which of them got top billing. And nobody wanted to do that, and they didn't want to be in that situation. There was another reason, though, I think, why they didn't spend a whole lot of time together. While they said adoring things anytime a journalist asked about one or the other in the trio, they were incredibly different. Louis Armstrong he wore his heart in his trumpet, in his voice, and on his sleeve, and he was all out there. Duke Ellington was an aristocrat. And as much as Louis Armstrong was a guy who felt comfortable in the streets, Duke Ellington felt comfortable in the White House, and Count Basie was so private that nobody exactly knows what he was like behind the scenes, other than any chance he got, he turned down requests to be candid about anything in his life. And I think that they were really different personalities and had friends who were like them, and that meant not one another.
Each of them had a theme or a couple of themes that are associated with them, and I'd love to hear you talk about those. Let's start with Take the A-Train. How did Take the A-Train become such a great song and Duke's theme song?
So anybody who spent time getting to know New York knows that the A-Train is a train that will take you to Harlem. And when a young guy named Billy Strayhorn wanted a job with Duke Ellington, Billy Strayhorn was living in Pittsburgh, and he called Duke up on the phone and said, "You remember me? We ran into one another, and you told me when I graduated from school to call you, and you'd give me a tryout." And Ellington said, "Sure, I remember. Come to New York, and we'll talk." And he gave him directions on how to make it to where he lived in Harlem. Strayhorn decided he was young, he was smart, and he had a lot of chutzpah. And he decided that if he could convert the directions that Duke had given him into a composition and show it to Duke at that tryout, he would get the job. He was right. He did it. He got the job. And I would say about once in every three times that the Ellington Band played Take the A-Train, Duke would bother to credit Billy Strayhorn. And the other two-thirds of the time, listeners would assume that it was one of Ellington's 6,000 compositions. But Ellington loved it enough that it became his signature song, and audiences wouldn't let him get away with doing a performance without at least one rendition of A-Train. The song for Count Basie said a whole lot, I think, about Count Basie. The song that I think of as his signature song in his early years was 1 o'clock Jump. And that song, like anything the Basie Band was doing in their swinging Kansas City days, was one that they used to say that if you listened to the Basie Band playing 1 o'clock Jump and your toes weren't tapping, you should go see a doctor the next day because something was anatomically wrong with you. And that was characteristic of Basie's early swing. In his later years, the song that was, to me, the signature Basie song was called Fly Me to the Moon. And it was one that Frank Sinatra sang. The Basie Band was the backup. And that song, shockingly, actually did fly to the moon with the Apollo astronauts, and it made it even more famous. Louis Armstrong had a number of theme songs. In his early days, it was a very controversial song called When It's Sleepy Time Down South, which seemed to be glorifying life on the plantation. Now, if there was anybody who knew that life on the plantation wasn't something to be glorified, it was Louis Armstrong. He was describing what life was really like down the South, not saying that that was good. He spent his life pushing back against those Jim Crow strictures, and he said that he wouldn't go back to his native New Orleans until they would let him come with his integrated band and play before an integrated audience. So if that was his early and controversial theme song, at the end of his life, one of his themes was one we've already talked about, Hello Dolly, and the other was, to me, an even more moving song called It's a Wonderful World. And the idea that somebody who came from the world that Louis Armstrong did could be singing with passion and making you believe that it was a wonderful world said something about this guy's optimism and his grace.
Well, that song, It's a Wonderful World, is really a pop song. I mean, the arrangement is a string arrangement. It's really a vocalist's record.
It is, and that was what Louis was doing a lot at the end of his life. He was recording albums of Christmas songs. He could take a rock and roll song and make it into his own song. He could own anything. And it was saying, my lips are tired, and the idea of blowing a trumpet is a whole lot more exertion on them than singing a song. So he would take a break from the trumpet playing by singing. But it was also, the guy could create hits whether it was with an instrument or using his vocals as an instrument.
I have a 45 of Louis Armstrong reciting "Twas the Night Before Christmas."
Exactly.
Talk a little bit about their life on the road. You spend a lot of time in the book talking about it. It's so fascinating. I really feel like I'm there. But let me just ask you to start with the trains. You spend some time in your book, and I feel like there's a whole book there talking about the Pullman porters and how that all began.
So 20 years ago, I wrote a book on these black men who worked on the railroad called Pullman Porters. And from the end of the Civil War to the 1960s, the most elegant and comfortable way you could make your way across America in the era before planes and even in the early days of airplanes was by taking George Pullman's sleeping car across country. Elegant bedding, elegant food, just a really comfortable way of traveling. And for Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie, when they had enough money, they were fascinated by taking not just any train, but Pullman sleeping cars. Trains to blacks of their era had always represented freedom in a metaphorical way through the Underground Railroad and in a literal way because trains were taking people out of the South and taking them to places where they had more freedoms. When these three guys went below the Mason-Dixon line, they would, if they made the wrong choice of a restaurant that they tried to go into or of a hotel they tried to book a room, they could be berated, they could be beaten, and in the worst case, but in too many cases, blacks who made those kinds of wrong choices ended up at the end of a lynching noose. So what they did is they essentially rented a hotel to go south with them in the form of this private Pullman sleeping car. And at the end of their late night concert, they would go back to the Pullman car, knowing they had a great meal waiting for them. They had a plush bed made by the Pullman porters, and they had safety. And that was the only way to ensure it. And in return, what they did for the Pullman porters was in the middle of the night, in this closed capsule of a railroad car, they would do a private jam session just for the Pullman porters. And Gary, I don't know about you, but if I could go back to any moment in history, it might well be having the Duke Ellington Orchestra perform just for me.
It sounds great. What's the name of your Pullman Porter book? And how come I don't know about it already? Sorry.
So I can't answer the second question. The first one I can tell you, the book is called Rising from the Rails, The Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. And the book made the argument that more than teachers, more than ministers, more than the careers we generally associate with having spawned a generation of a black middle class and a black professionals, the Pullman porters gave rise to this new set of opportunities for their children and their grandchildren. And whether it's Michelle Obama or Thurgood Marshall or just about anybody famous in black history over the last half century, they all have a Pullman porter who was a father or an uncle or a grandfather who helped inspire them to do what they did.
Was it racism in the sense that they were in servitude? They were all called George, weren't they all called? That was not a thing they all called George.
They were. So they were hired generally as ex-slaves. That was what George Pullman figured was the best way to ensure that they were going to be the perfect servants. He also knew that if he paid them exactly half of what they needed to live on, that they would depend on tips for the other half of their income, and they would do anything that a passenger asked, whether it was to sew their pants or to get the fly out of their sleeping area or to keep their mouth shut when you ended up in the berth of somebody who wasn't your spouse on that long, lonely trip across America. The Pullman porters were the perfect servants, but they also were called too much by racist white passengers, George, in that insidious tradition where slaves were named after their slave master. And people assumed these were George Pullman slaves. But over the years, their salaries increased, their tips stayed steady. They had a chance to see America in a way that no black men did of that era. And just keeping their ears open, they heard what the wealthiest and most powerful Americans were talking about, everything from a stock tip to the importance of a college education, and they became celebrities in their black communities, much like another group of guys who I wrote a book about, who were the Negro League ballplayers, the two, arguably the two most celebrated people in the black world from the late 1800s into the mid-1900s, were ballplayers like Satchel Paige and Pullman Porters.
Well, Larry Tye, for our listeners who can't see you, you're a white guy, and you've written at least half of your literary output has been devoted to African American history. So what makes Larry Tye interested in that?
So what makes me interested? So I think there are two questions here. What makes me interested, and am I a credible storyteller, and have I expropriated other people's stories?
What makes me interested?
Yes. So what makes me interested is partly that I think race remains, as we can see every day today, the story of America. From the notion of Reconstruction through the Jim Crow era through today's lingering signs of racism, it is a huge piece of what makes our country unusual and what we still struggle against. And I think that I am Jewish, and growing up as an outsider, as a Jew, I also think it makes me especially interested in the story of a group that were even more outsiders in the American mainstream culture, who were blacks. And it's no accident that the three guys I just wrote about, Armstrong, Ellington, and Basie, all had Jewish managers, all had Jewish bandmates, and all had Jewish friends, because they shared so much in an experience in America and using stories to talk about that experience. But what makes me credible is a tougher question for me to answer. And I think that I would answer it the way that I think Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie might have answered it, which is, we want people to look at something like a book and not think, was the person who wrote it black or white, but is the story told well or not? And they wanted America to be a colorblind America in terms of their artistic output. And I would like the same thing. And I would say that my first book about the Pullman Porters was because I was intrigued by them and the story of race in America. It was the Pullman Porters who made me promise that someday I would write a book about their favorite sports figure that they ever carried on their trains, and that was Satchel Paige, and about their all-time favorite passengers, who were named Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie. So at least the latter two books, I blame on them.
And Satchel Paige does make a cameo in your new book. I was happy to see his name again. And so do Siegel and Shuster, the Jewish creators of Superman. And you draw a parallel between African-American musicians and Jewish comic book artists in a way. Their opportunity was there.
So exactly, I do. So having written biographies of Superman and Satchel, I couldn't resist bringing them into this new book. But I also think that for the same reason Jews were not allowed into the white stocking professions like advertising and like magazine writing, and they had to go to this upstart profession of comic books, that is why they ended up there. And what they did when they were there is they created brilliant characters like Superman and Batman and Spider-Man that remain the Mount Rushmore trio of comic book heroes. And it was the same with jazz. One of the reasons that blacks and Jews ended up in jazz was it was an upstart profession. They would have had a much tougher time were they trying to play classical music and join symphony orchestras. And so they did what they were able to do. They took their instincts and their musical genius into the form that was the most all-American and most rollicking and most open-minded, which was jazz.
Well, where Louis Armstrong kind of blended the lines or blurred the lines between pop music and jazz music, Ellington tried to sort of blur the line between serious music and jazz music. Would you say that's true?
I would say it's definitely true that he wrote songs like Take the A Train that were toe-tapping fun. And he wrote concerts. He wrote symphonies like Black, Brown, and Beige that were among the greatest symphonic forms that we've seen. He wrote sacred music that was played in churches and synagogues around the world. He loved trying to defy a sense that he was going to be categorized. And his famous expression was, "I am beyond category." And much like he lived up to the title of Duke, he lived up to the notion that he could cross from one category to another and do just about anything and do it well.
Well, all three of these guys, any of them were perfect. And you do talk about it in your book, and I wonder if that was difficult, but you talk about the sort of misogynistic attitudes that they had, which I guess were pretty common among everybody in those days, but they had, because they were musicians on the road, just like the rock musicians to come, they took advantage of that situation.
All three were men of deep faith. All three said, and I believe that they believed in God. All three prayed before meals. All three said they had read the Bible. Duke said he had read it cover to cover three times. But all three, if we were to go one by one through the Ten Commandments, broke them pretty regularly. And the one that is clearest and easiest to document is the one about being faithful to a spouse. Louis Armstrong was married four times, and even with his fourth and longest lasting by far wife, Lucille Armstrong, he was what he admitted was unfaithful and what she knew was unfaithful. Count Basie was only married twice, but he was unfaithful enough to his wife, his long lasting wife, Catherine Basie, that she walked out on him a couple times. And Duke Ellington stayed married to the same woman his entire life. But that was not because he lived with her as her husband. It was because it gave him cover with his mistresses. He could say to them, you know, you want me to marry you. I'm already married, and you don't want me to go through an expensive divorce. Mm-hmm. And so he had enough mistresses that when his granddaughter Mercedes Ellington, gave me a Duke Ellington tour of Harlem, we went to all the places that he had played. We went to all the places that he had lived, but the longest part of the tour was all the places he had stashed a mistress, and there were apartments all across the city.
Well, there's a lot of research. Obviously, your books are always very well documented in research, but who did you talk to in writing this book?
So in total, I talked to about 250 people, and I was naive. I thought that if you were writing a biography about three people, you only had to do a third of the work on each of them. Oh. And obviously, anybody smart would know that you have to do enough that you really know and can speak to what they're like, whether there are three of them or one. And so I talked to, with all three of them, their friends, any bandmates who are still alive, relatives. I talked to jazz greats like Wynton Marsalis and Sonny Rollins and John Batiste. I talked to politicians to try to understand their effect on the political world. Bill Clinton loved to go on and on about all three of them and said that he had posters of them in his house. I talked to historians. I talked to all kinds of people who are a whole lot smarter than me and who made me a whole lot smarter than I started out with, to the point where I was able to hopefully write a book that made some sense.
How did you connect with President Clinton? You have his number?
So that was a very strange thing. It was during the pandemic, and I was doing a town in the little village that I live in on Cape Cod. The village had basically had a party to come out from the pandemic in the only safe place that you could do that, which was in a baseball stadium, part of this Cape Cod Baseball League network. And in this outdoor stadium, we had in the infield a jazz band, and we had me talking about my book. And when I got home that afternoon, having done this wonderfully uplifting talk on a book that was still in progress, I had a voicemail waiting, and it said, "This is Bill Clinton's press secretary. Would you give me a call? The president wants to talk to you." And I thought it was some friend pretending to be Bill Clinton. So I called the number, and 15 minutes later or 10 minutes later, I was on the phone with somebody whose voice was never to be mistaken. Nobody could duplicate a Bill Clinton. And he wanted to talk about the last book that I had written, which was a biography of Joe McCarthy. He had lived through the McCarthy era, and he was intrigued about McCarthy. But 10 minutes into the conversation, he asked, "What are you writing about now?" And when I told him, that the conversation switched entirely to jazz and to fun. And he talked about how these guys had done just what I was trying to say that they had done, that they had truly changed America and had opened our hearts to the idea that Blacks not just were geniuses like these three guys were, but that if they could be geniuses like that, didn't they deserve some sense of equal humanity and equal rights?
Well, since you mentioned your previous book, Demagogue, I want everybody to go and get it and read it. I mean, I want them to read The Jazzman too, because it's great. But before November, everybody should read Demagogue, I believe.
So I think the book was called Demagogue rather than McCarthy because it was about all the bullies who came before Joe McCarthy and all the ones up to today who continue to use his precise playbook. And there are enough that it seems like a relevant story and too relevant.
Too, unfortunately, too relevant. It would be nice if that was just history, wouldn't it?
It would be.
So, Larry Tai, I understand you're coming to San Francisco.
I am. On the 14th of July, I'm coming there for a talk at a place called Bird and Beckett Bookstore. And on the 17th, I'm coming to do a talk at Mechanics Institute, the wonderful library in the city. So I will be there both evenings. Those and all my other talks are listed at LarryTye.com. And I appreciate being able to put in that plug.
Well, this book, it's a masterpiece, Larry Tye. What do you, before I sign off, what are you going to do next? What's your next project that Gary Shapiro can't wait to read?
So I always get anxious when I've finished a book that I will never find a topic that I like as much and that a publisher will never want to buy that topic from me. And so this time, even before I handed in The Jazzman, I had signed up for my next book. And the title is The Forger of Paris, Adolfo Kaminsky and Jewish Resistance to the Holocaust. And it's trying through the story of this Adolfo Kaminsky, who died a year ago, to tell the story that Jews did not go like lambs to slaughter, that they fought back everywhere from the death camps and the partisan bands in the forest to the underground movement and the Allied army. And Adolfo Kaminsky was a young Jewish counterfeiter in the underground movement in France. And he saved what his New York Times obituary said was 10,000 lives. And so in miniature, his story tells this broader story that I wanted to talk about.
Well, that sounds fantastic. And when will we see it? A year?
So it depends how many podcasts and radio interviews I do over the next year on Jazzmen. But I hope it will be into the publisher in about a year and be out on the streets within a year after that.
Well, good. I look forward to our conversation about that. And I want to thank you for being here. The book is called The Jazzman, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. And the author, the brilliant Larry Tye, my guest. Thank you so much for being with us again on From the Bookshelf.
I appreciate your having me on, Gary.
Hello, Dolly. This is Louis, Dolly. It's so nice to have you back where you belong. You looking swell, Dolly. I can tell, Dolly. You still glowing, you still growing, you still going strong. I feel the room swaying while the band's playing one of our old favorite songs from way back when. So take a rap, fellas. Find an empty lap, fellas. Dolly, never go away again.
favorite song. Let me sing forevermore.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.